Ready to proceed?
May it please the Court, Ralph Durstein for the State of Delaware. The appellant in this case...
Mr. Durstein, I had thought there were introductions this morning. Are there not?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor. R.J. Skaggs, may it please the Court. I'm here to introduce Steve Patton from Kirkland & Ellis. He'll be making the argument on behalf of the original participating manufacturers.
Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. Harding Grain from Potter Anderson Perone. I'm here to introduce Robert Brookheiser from Howery LLP, and he will be representing the subsequent participating manufacturers.
Good morning and welcome. Okay, Mr. Durstein, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. This appeal presents an issue of contract interpretation for the Court. The master settlement agreement that was entered into by the State of Delaware and 51 other jurisdictions is a complex document, as I'm sure the Court has found. It has a focus that is in part national in terms of markets and in part local or state-based in terms of such things as enforcement. There's also a division of labor within the document, which assigns things like calculations to an independent auditor. A consultant is called upon to determine what's known as significant factor. And then there's the issue of enforcement, which was assigned to the courts, the MSA courts and the court below in the State of Delaware. I think we agree that the issue in this case is whether the present dispute arises out of calculations or determinations made by the independent auditor in this case. Or in the alternative, is this a dispute which falls within the exclusive jurisdiction of the court below, the MSA court in Delaware? It's the state's position that this dispute does not arise from any determination by the independent auditor because none was made. And it does not arise from a calculation because no calculation was made by the independent auditor that the state disputes. We have no problem with the independent auditor's calculation of market share, for example. That's not at issue here.
So if the auditor had actually made a determination of the issue in this case, which is with diligent enforcement,
correct.
Then any further review of that would be by arbitration. Is that right?
That's correct.
But if the auditor doesn't make an affirmative determination, but simply rests on a presumption, that goes to court.
That's correct.
What's the logic?
Well, the independent auditor was not equipped to deal with this issue of diligent enforcement. The auditor
was or wasn't, if he made the determination, you're in arbitration. The argument that you have to confront is that he made a determination by relying on a presumption. Why should the difference in forum and in process turn on that rather slender reed?
The reason why the appropriate forum would be the court for diligent enforcement is that's a fact law issue that a court is equipped to deal with and determine. The independent auditor is not equipped to determine diligent enforcement. Heard no facts, saw no exhibits, no witnesses, no testimony, no hearing, no argument, no findings.
Well, that would be an easier argument to make if there would be no arbitration in any event. That is, if the auditor, even if the auditor did make a determination, if that issue simply would not go before an arbitrator. But here you have a situation where if there is a determination, whether the auditor is competent to make it or not, you are in arbitration. And so you're really down, aren't you, to whether or not there was a determination made within the meaning of the agreement?
Well, I don't think that's necessarily the case. The division of labor here is that arbitration is to be applied to calculations, arithmetic, complicated arithmetic done by the auditor.
And determinations.
And determinations. But determinations would be a decision actually made by the independent arbitrator after a hearing or presentation of evidence, witnesses, exhibits, and so forth. None of that was done.
You talk about the independent arbitrator. Do you mean the auditor?
Independent auditor, I'm sorry, yes. That was not done in this case. And it's a sensible division of labor because when you look at the process of calculation, allocation that goes through some 13 or 14 steps under the Master Settlement Agreement, it's entirely possible that parties such as these would disagree as to the numbers that were reached. The auditor's role is kind of before and after the diligent enforcement determination. Initially, there's the market share determination. Then there has to be a determination of diligent enforcement based on what happens in each individual state. And then once those decisions are made, it's a yes or no decision as to each of the 52 jurisdictions, then the independent auditor is called back into the picture to determine the complex series of adjustments and set-offs and allocations that are made depending upon what the findings have been as to the individual states. It was never envisioned that the auditor would have a role in determining diligent enforcement, only in assigning the numbers.
What's the record support for that statement? That it was never envisioned.
That's the nature of the whole scheme of the Master Settlement Agreement.
I just asked for the record support.
Well, the record here, it's a contract case, and we're relying on the terms of the agreement itself, the way in which it was enacted.
So you're saying that that under your reading of the agreement, one could conclude that it was never envisioned.
That's right. The other aspect of it is that the auditor's role in this is as to nationwide determinations, market, things of that. It's clear from the MSA there was never any intent to determine market share or significant factor on a state-by-state basis, but rather on a nationwide tobacco market basis, and that was done. We don't dispute it. However, when it comes to diligent enforcement, it's clear that has to be done on a state-by-state basis, regardless of who the forum ultimately might be. It has to be done on a state-by-state basis. So the auditor is ill-equipped to do that.
Where would we look outside of Section 11C of the MSA to resolve this dispute? Is there somewhere else to go, or do we just look at that paragraph, resolution of disputes?
I don't disagree that that's the place to start, because it defines the scope.
Well, that's why I'm asking, is there anywhere else to go that amplifies it that helps your argument?
Yeah, a couple places. Section 7C that we cite is the section that defines the jurisdiction of the MSA courts. And that's also a very broad, continuing, retained jurisdiction over the subject matter of the agreement and the consent decree over each of the participating manufacturers for purposes of ongoing enforcement. And it's clear, it says in Section 7, that our Court of Chancery would be the only court to which disputes under the MSA or the consent decrees are presented. The other place I would refer the court, Section 11C, the arbitration clause of the MSA, also it refers to arbitration of such things as adjustments, reductions, offsets, carry forwards, and allocations, and then cites Section 9J. Now, 9J is the section that talks about the order of application of these allocations, offsets, reductions, and adjustments. I wouldn't have the court go through that whole section. It's complicated. But the significance of it is the arbitration clause is saying we're going to take these complex computations and allocations. And for those matters, we're not going to burden the court with that. We're going to have a panel of arbitrators resolve any disputes over the numbers. So once the diligent enforcement determination is made by the court in each of the states, that number is then applied, and there's an allocation between the states. There's every possibility of error there or disagreement as to the computations. That is the kind of thing the arbitration clause refers to. The arbitration clause never mentions diligent enforcement. It never mentions taking away the power of the MSA court to decide that issue. There's no description of how a process might work whereby diligent enforcement would be arbitrated as to each of 52 different jurisdictions.
Well, other states have decided this to the contrary, haven't they?
Yes, Your Honor.
How do we deal with that, or how should we approach those decisions?
I would ask that this court approach it de novo, review this agreement. The count of jurisdictions, as I have it, is 41 total, which have reached a decision adverse to our position here. 13 of those orders are final, as of my last count. 28 of those are pending appeal. The court's aware of the North Dakota decision that we've cited, which is contrary to the majority view, and it shows the other point of view with respect to arbitration. We believe the North Dakota case was decided correctly. I think the court should also be mindful that many of the courts that have the trial courts, MSA courts in the various states, are trial courts of general jurisdiction with a busy docket, probably courts that are not eager to take on an issue such as this. In our state, we're fortunate to have the Court of Chancery as our MSA court, a court much better equipped to deal with this kind of business dispute in a quick manner and to resolve it.
Well, I agree with that in principle. There's a distinct absence of eagerness detectable from the opinion from the Court of Chancery.
That's true. And in fact, there's a portion on page 12 where the court suggests that perhaps there might be factors that would militate against having a state court decide this.
What do we do about the oft-quoted policy judgment of this court that we favor arbitration, that as a matter of state policy, arbitration is encouraged?
I don't think that should be applied here. And the reason is the policy behind arbitration is normally to expedite disputes, to solve them quickly and with as little time and money involved as possible. That's absolutely turned on its head by the situation here. If this matter had been heard by the Court of Chancery beginning a year ago when our action was filed, it's likely that the loser in that diligent enforcement determination would have filed an appeal, and we'd be before this court deciding the final issue that needs to be decided here, diligent enforcement, instead of squabbling about arbitration. As it is, a year after we filed this action, and despite these 41 decisions in favor of some kind of arbitration scheme, there have been no arbitration hearings, there have been no arbitrators selected, there has been little or no progress toward arbitration. So the policy that normally would support arbitration, and I recognize that's the law of the state, should not be applied where it would yield a result that's totally contrary to the usual objectives of that policy. We can resolve this matter more quickly and with less expense by litigating in the Court of Chancery, reaching a decision, than waiting in line for arbitration with 51 other jurisdictions under an arbitration scheme that has yet to be fleshed out or defined and has yielded no results in a year now.
So we go back to whether the parties wisely provided for arbitration in their contract or not. It gets back to basic contract interpretation.
That's correct. It gets back to the intent of the parties. And the intent of the state of Delaware, the expectation when we entered into this back in 1999, was that the auditor would calculate this market share loss, as has been done, not disputed. It says that the economic consultant would determine whether that market share loss was a significant, or whether the obligations under the MSA were a significant factor in that market share loss. That's been done. And then the expectation that the state had was that it could take advantage of this safe harbor provision by showing enactment of the statutes, which has been done, and that's conceded, and diligent enforcement.
Now we're back to Justice Jacobs' question. You're telling us that that's the state's expectation, but I go back to his question. What in the record supports that view?
Well, what supports that is the structure and the philosophy behind the Master Settlement Agreement, which assigns these national issues to the auditor or to the economic consultant, and these state issues on a state-by-state basis retain jurisdiction of the MSA court, the Court of Chancery in this case. That's the way that the MSA was designed, And it's reasonable, I would argue, for the state to have the expectation that it would go to court to establish diligent enforcement, because there's no reference in the arbitration provision to litigating that issue, to presenting that issue to an arbitration panel on a nationwide basis or otherwise.
Yet there is no paragraph in the master agreement that states what you just said.
It's actually, that's correct, it's silent. Nowhere in the MSA will look in vain to find a plain statement of whether diligent enforcement is to be arbitrated or diligent enforcement is to be litigated in the MSA court. It simply is silent on that critical issue, which is why we're here.
If I read the majority opinions of the, or let me put it this way, if I read the opinions of the states that constitute the majority on this issue, they seem to suggest that because diligent enforcement affects the adjustments and the arbitrators intended to affect the adjustments, then diligent enforcement is within the purview of arbitration.
Yeah.
Why is that wrong?
That's wrong because the courts are relying on the fact that there's a relationship there between diligent enforcement and the adjustments, but they're not focusing on what the arbitration clause really says, which is if you dispute the adjustment, if you dispute the way in which the diligent enforcement decision was taken and plugged into a formula, then you can dispute that formula, those calculations. That's what the auditor does. At no place does it say if you dispute the substantive decision on diligent enforcement. It is related because diligent enforcement, whether it's favorable or unfavorable to the state, will yield a number or an allocation that affects the other states. That's regardless of who decides it. But it's the number that's subject to arbitration, not the diligent enforcement substantive determination.
Well, but you can't really argue that if the diligent enforcement issue went to arbitration, that the arbitration panel would be not competent to decide it. After all, we're talking about three retired federal judges.
The problem we have with that, Your Honor, is that process is never defined in the master settlement agreement, so we would be walking blindly into a process that we didn't anticipate. It hasn't been fleshed out.
Well, it isn't fleshed out either way. I mean, under your scenario, you've got litigation in 51 states.
Well, and that's right. And
that's not fleshed out either.
Well, it's fleshed out to the extent that the MSA makes clear that the MSA court in each state has retained jurisdiction for purposes of enforcement or determining disputes under the consent decree or the agreement. And both parties should have the expectation that those courts would hear evidence as to diligent enforcement and would make a determination based on that state's market conditions and the enforcement efforts of the Attorney General or the party charged with responsibility and yield a decision.
Well, and when that happened, it would potentially affect the calculation. And
that
would be arbitrable. So instead of shortening the process, you'd have the court making a decision independently on diligent enforcement, then an arbitrator determining what the effect that decision would have on any adjustment to the calculation, so you go right back to arbitration inevitably in any event, don't you?
Well, I don't think it would lengthen the entire process, because regardless of who determines diligent enforcement, those decisions will then, state by state, be plugged into the allocation, the formula process.
I'm just trying to understand why it would be more efficient for the Court of Chancery in Delaware to decide this case, understanding all the points you made. That,
right.
And this isn't the first instance where we've heard argument that by going to arbitration we've delayed the result given the efficiencies of the Court of Chancery. But our job is to decide what the parties intended to do.
Sure.
But I'm trying to understand how, in this context, if the purpose of diligent enforcement is to affect an adjustment in a calculation,
right,
but arbitration exists to determine the ultimate calculation, how this speeds up the process.
It speeds it up for purposes of Delaware, because we could get into the court, we could make our showing, we could have a decision from the court, and we would know in Delaware, if the fund was favorable to the state, we'd know there would be no adverse impact on the funds coming into Delaware. We would know that the $4.5 million roughly at stake is secure. So for purposes of Delaware, we would have that knowledge. If it was an adverse finding, then we would know we were going to be put into a pot, so to speak, with other states where there was no diligent enforcement and there'd be an allocation and we would lose funds. We wouldn't know what the funds were until all the states had reached a decision. But regardless of whether that's done by a court or by arbitrators in other states, that yes or no decision on diligent enforcement, once they're all made, it's true. Nothing can happen until all 52 jurisdictions have reached a decision. Then the formula is done, depending upon what happens. But the efficiency is that in Delaware we'd be able to have a decision, and if it's favorable, we know the funds are secure. We don't have to go scrambling around to replace $4.5 million.
So, in effect, a weak analogy would be we're the valedictorian of the class, but the class still won't graduate.
Won't graduate until that last class member has...
At least not on time.
Weighed in. Yeah. I think I have overstepped my time here. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is Steve Patton, and I'm going to speak this morning on behalf of the three OPMs. We've got lots of acronyms here, abbreviations, and then Bob Brookhiser is going to use the remaining time for the SPMs. As this Court knows, this dispute concerns whether Vice Chancellor Lamb correctly ruled that the party's dispute about the independent auditor's determination to deny an NPM adjustment, including the state's defense that that adjustment shouldn't apply to it because it diligently enforced, is required to be arbitrated by the arbitration clause's plain language, where that language provides not only that appeals from particular determinations made by the independent auditor are arbitrable, but any dispute arising out of or relating to the auditor's calculations and determinations, and then goes further and provides a list of examples of disputes that are arbitrable, quote, including without limitation any dispute concerning the operation or application of the adjustments, and it continues on, and allocations described in subsection 9J of the agreement. And subsection 9J, in turn, specifically describes not only the NPM adjustment, but also the diligent enforcement exemption. And Vice Chancellor Lamb, in a thorough and well-reasoned decision, joined 42 of 43 other courts, including all three appellate courts, to so far address the issue, and saying, in so many words, this isn't even close. The language here plainly applies. And we ask this Court, consistent not only with public policy favoring arbitration, but even more fundamental public policy in this state, of holding parties to the agreement that they entered into. How do we determine that agreement? Not by what I or Mr. Dirksen says the parties intended or how surprised we are, but by the language, the objective manifestation of the parties' shared intent, not some subsequent claim of unilateral intent. So we ask this Court to affirm the lower court here, affirm Vice Chancellor Lamb, both because of the plain language of the agreement, because of the very structure of this multi-jurisdiction national agreement, and the need to have one umpire telling this one independent auditor what the rules of the game are so this whole thing doesn't devolve into a balkanization of 52 separate state and territorial courts reaching conflicting decisions on the same decision. And third and finally, if there were any dispute about the issue, any ambiguity, and we respectfully submit that there is not and should not be here, it would be resolved by the well-settled presumption in favor of arbitration, which applies to this contract because this is governed by the Federal Arbitration Act, both because it involves interstate commerce, but because the parties expressly in Section 11C invoke the FAA, but it wouldn't matter. The law of this state is equally well-settled. Now, in that last regard,
It appears that both sides seem to be arguing that this Court has got to glean the intent of the parties from the structure of the agreement, whatever that might be. In terms of balkanization, don't we have balkanization under either scenario? That is, under the plaintiff's scenario or the appellant scenario, we have litigation in 50 separate state courts. Under your scenario, we have one tribunal, but with 50 separate proceedings to determine diligent enforcement.
The reason why balkanization won't result, I respectfully submit, from the latter of a will from the former is it's undisputed that the determination as to any one state's diligent enforcement not only affects that state but every other state. I've likened this on many occasions to a game of musical chairs where at the end of the game there may be one seat left open, but there's multiple states potentially that are left holding the bag for the entirety of the NPM adjustment. It is therefore important, and why these other 42 courts have consistently held that this needs to be decided, not only that the language requires arbitration, and that's first and foremost, but that this was a wise choice and consistent with the overall structure, is the need for uniformity, Your Honor.
I'm not sure exactly what you're telling us. And what I'm hearing is that if we have litigation on diligent enforcement in 50 separate states, each court that decides that issue can basically ignore whatever any other court has stated. But if those 50 separate disputes are litigated under the umbrella of the arbitrators, then somehow they can't or won't ignore it. But why should these determinations be interdependent on each other at all?
Well, I was trying to make two points I think I was doing inartfully. One is there's one contractual standard that governs. Your Honor is right that there are fact-specific, enforcement efforts, but the contract doesn't say that there's 52. There's one contractual standard, diligent enforcement. And the balkanization could come, and I believe would come, if you had 52 separate courts defining that one contractual standard in potentially conflicting and inconsistent ways. But the second point that I wanted to make is because this determination is to any one state not only affects the payments of that state, but the payments of the other 51 states, there are more stakeholders than what would appear before the Delaware Chancery Court or the California Superior Court or any of these courts. All of the states potentially have an interest and a stake in terms of the diligent enforcement determination as to any other state.
I'm not sure I follow. Are you saying that if this matter does go to arbitration, there will be one arbitration that involves every state and it will be one massive proceeding, or will there be an arbitration for Delaware and an arbitration for any other state that has an issue about the allocation?
Well, the contract language requires one panel. Whether that panel, and the reason for that, it says each side to the dispute, doesn't say each party, each state, each participating manufacturer, and it says dispute, not each issue, whether Delaware or New Jersey or Massachusetts. There's going to be one panel. Whether that panel elects how it elects to conduct its business, where it does a seriatim of individual proceedings for individual states, Justice Berger, we don't know that yet. What practically, I think we all, certainly I won't speak for others, I anticipate happening, and this came up in the transcript, Vice Chancellor Lamb commented when an argument made by the state today about delay and chaos and the like, that practically, what I expect to happen is that after there's disclosure of what the facts really are about the diligent enforcement efforts, it will be a much more limited group of states that are then in dispute than 52, that the arbitration panel will hear the evidence, will determine what this uniform nationwide standard is, and presumably apply it consistently to all the states whose diligent enforcement efforts are then in dispute.
Okay,
and then we'll have the guidance.
Let me stop you there, because I'm trying to understand this at a very practical level as to how it's going to work. And I gather that all over the country there are disputes right now about this allocation, right? And there are all these decisions from lower courts, and a few of them are already up to the appellate courts. But as a practical matter, aren't you telling us that there will be no arbitration anywhere until the last highest court in the land has ruled on whether that particular jurisdiction goes to arbitration or not? Because until that time, the arbitration panel wouldn't have everybody in front of it. Right?
I'm not telling Your Honor that. We expect to, first of all, the only reason why there's been delay in this initial arbitration is because the states have been fighting arbitrability, and that has presented a threshold issue. I hope and fully expect it's a one-time threshold issue. Once we get through all this litigation and it's resolved where this is going to be adjudicated, this will then in the future be determined in the efficient nationwide way that the parties anticipate. But the answer to your question is no. We are not going to wait to every single state. When there is a
I don't understand how you cannot wait.
Well, when there is a critical mass of states that as to which is final, and by our count it's now 17, including California and a number of large states, at some point our intent is to go forward with the selection of arbitrators and with the arbitration, and if there are tag-alongs, to use a class action analogy, we're going to give them notice that the train is leaving the station. We want to avoid prejudicing those states. Now, bear in mind, we have trial court rulings ordering arbitration in 42 of the 48 states that are in dispute here, and all the rest have been fully briefed, and we will have the trial court determinations shortly. We have final determinations in 17 states. We have motions to dismiss appeals in many of the others because appealability varies jurisdiction by jurisdiction, and a few remaining appeals to argue. But we do not take the position that we have to wait till every last one. We're going to give notice and allow people to participate, and if the panel then has to turn its attention to some tag-along states that are finally ordered to arbitration after we get going forward. But again, Justice Berger, I want to emphasize the delay here. The PMs here paid $1.1 billion a year ago that they didn't think they had to pay. You know, we would have liked to start this arbitration a year ago when it should have started, and I think it comes with ill grace for the states to cite delay as an excuse for not enforcing the agreement according to its plain terms, when the only reason there's been delay in this initial arbitration is because they've resisted arbitration, at every state.
So you're saying that while this matter is unresolved, the companies are making the payments?
Yes. All that I hope that was clear from the briefs, all of that $1.1 billion in dispute was paid. Either was paid to an escrow, which was directly distributed to the states, or it was paid into a disputed payments account, as the MSA permits, where it's sitting in Citibank, an escrow account in New York, earning interest at prevailing rates. All the money's been paid. Nobody's being prejudiced by the delay in having this resolve. If anyone is prejudiced by this delay, it's the manufacturers, because they are paying. And we'll pay in another week, on April 15th, another $1.1 billion that we don't think we owe. We've satisfied, or they have satisfied, all the requirements for the MPM adjustment. As your honors know, Section 91 provides that the adjustment, quote, shall apply when two requirements are met. There's a market share loss. No question that these companies have hemorrhaged market share. They used to have 99.some-odd%. And as soon as they started paying $5 a carton more than the non-participants and had all these restrictions on advertising, all that market share shifted. So that's been met. And secondly, an independent economic consulting firm has now determined for the first 2 years, for 03 and 04, that the MSA was a significant factor contributing to that market share loss. So they've satisfied the requirements. The only thing that's holding us up is the auditor latching on to the state's argument that, well, you should presume that all of us diligently enforce and deny the adjustment, and now the states are saying, and by golly, we did diligently enforce, and we want to assert that defense. So we have every incentive to get this resolved as promptly as possible.
One quick follow-up to Justice Berger's question. Assuming that you could get all of the arbitrability issue resolved before the end of this year, you're then at a point where 2003 has to be decided for whatever time that would take.
That's
correct?
Right. And then we're going to
have to go 2004 and play catch up.
Yes.
And each year that you would be playing catch-up, there would be a redetermination of diligent enforcement. I mean, this whole process would have to be repeated for each year.
No, I don't think so, Judge, because I think that, again, practically what will happen is once this panel of all three mutual former federal judges hears the parties' positions and gives guidance in terms of what constitutes diligent enforcement. And I expect that's going to be fairly concrete, factual guidance, which I've never understood why the states don't want to get that guidance. You know, find out what the bar is, find out what the benchmark is so you can conform your conduct accordingly. But for whatever reason, once that's determined, then we should have a set of criteria that the parties can then apply, that the independent auditor can apply, and I would expect that the amount of disputes, and quite frankly, the number of states whose diligent enforcement is disputed will narrow and be reduced as years go on. We won't have to go through the long process of defining what diligent enforcement means. And I guess I would finally cite the example of the significant factor determination.
Well, your answer to my question is yes, there will have to be separate determinations for each year, but after the first year, it should be simpler.
Yes, and faster and quicker with less proceeding. The example, the analog, it's the only one we've got, but it's not a bad one, is the significant factor determination. Now, there we had a Nobel laureate economist deciding what significant factor means. And the states made me the same way. Well, a significant factor is not defined in the MSA. We had arguments about it, what it means and what it required. And it took 3 years for that process to get started. We started it in June of 2005, and it was completed with the final determination according to the schedule that the parties agreed to and the procedures that they agreed to on the day that the final determination was to be made, and that was last March. That precipitated the demand for the relief that was denied here. We've just completed, a couple of months ago, the determination significant factor for 2004, and we've already started the 2005 determination. So, Justice Jacobs, it is true that both with significant factor and here with diligent enforcement, there is a ramp-up time.
You're on parallel tracks, is what you're saying?
Yes. Yeah. And we expect to get this diligent enforcement up to speed as well and on. But again, while you're right that other courts have looked at the structure and the threat of chaos and the problems of having this determined and where there could be conflicting standards and where all the stakeholders couldn't be heard, again, it's the language of the contract that is controlling here. I have often likened the payment structure to really the reason why it's so important for courts to apply the bargain that the parties agreed to, because this multi-jurisdictional agreement really does rest on that. But it's the language, and I'll end with one thought. Probably the most striking thing to me in reading the state's brief is they don't even quote the operative language until page 23 of a 35-page brief, and then our brief is completely about the language, and I look at the reply, and they don't even address the language at all. And we still have heard no response today, no alternate interpretation as how this language couldn't apply here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. May it please the Court. Bob Brookhiser on behalf of the subsequent participating manufacturers, who, as the Court is aware, are relatively smaller companies who, with one exception in a few states, were never sued by any of these states, yet voluntarily signed the Master Settlement Agreement, voluntarily agreed to make the substantial payments required by the Master Settlement Agreement, and voluntarily agreed to the conduct restrictions. As smaller companies compete directly on a price basis with the non-participating manufacturers, the SPMs are keenly interested in the language of the MSA, which sets forth the operation and application of the non-participating manufacturers adjustment, which was designed to try to level the playing field and encourage the states to enact and diligently enforce a qualifying statute. As smaller companies that can't afford to go around the country and litigate simultaneously in 50-some jurisdictions, we are also interested in the language of the arbitration agreement, which provides explicitly in the including without limitation clause that disputes, any dispute about the operation or application of any of the adjustments and the allocation of any of the adjustments, one of which being the MPM adjustment, should be and must be submitted to arbitration. We support the Vice Chancellor Lamb's decision for all the reasons that Mr. Patton has articulately explained, but there are just a couple of points that I wanted to make in response to some of the points that the state had made. First of all, the state, in response to some of your questions, said that it was relying on the jurisdictional provisions of the MSA, Section 7, for the MSA court, as the reason why the MSA court should decide diligent enforcement. But those provisions, as we point out in our briefs, specifically exclude disputes that are arbitral and specifically exclude 9D, which is the diligent enforcement and MPM adjustment. They also said that it was the state's intention and what they envisioned. And as Your Honors correctly recognized, you answer that question by looking at the language. And indeed, the MSA specifically says that the parties agree that there won't be any extrinsic evidence and that the construction of the MSA will not be construed against either party in the drafting. So you have to look at the language. There's been no answer for why this isn't arbitrable, and we think that Vice Chancellor Lamb's decision should be affirmed.
Thank you.
Very quickly, the answer to Justice Berger's question as to the form of the arbitration process, the honest answer, I think, would be no one knows at this point, a year later, as to what form or shape that's going to take. I would point out that the state in filing the appeal did not seek a stay of the court's order below. So we took a gamble there that the arbitration process would continue and we'd be compelled to participate in it. A year later, that did not happen.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.